You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear that unites your team in comfort and style. It's clothing that bolsters your brand identity and creates a unique connection between your brand, your employees, and your customers. It's why Lands' End Outfitters has been a supplier of branded apparel to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. From logo polos to fully customized branded wardrobes, our world-class outfitters will partner with you to help your team feel confident on the job and put your brand into action. From logo application to online ordering, Lands' End Outfitters offers seamless solutions that give you peace of mind, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters should be your branded apparel partner. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code POD20 for 20% off your first product.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky, proud partner and supporter of the Republic of Ireland Women's National Football Team.
This is News Talk.
Now, I'm sure lots of you have seen Wayne Rooney and Amazon have teamed up to release a new documentary, which is out this week. I think certainly Friday on Amazon Prime, maybe premieres this evening. And in advance of the documentary's release, Rooney did a number of eye-catching interviews, including with Ollie Holt, who's the chief sports writer with the Mail on Sunday. And we regularly review the Sunday papers here in our Sunday paper review slot. And I can tell you most weeks, one of the guests will pick out an Ollie Holt column or a brilliant interview. So it's great to have him on the show. And certainly the Wayne Rooney one caught the eye. Ollie, it's great to have you on. Thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Joe. I think it's a little while since we spoke. I think maybe the last time we spoke was when I did a Tyson Fury interview, which was about 6 years ago. So I was starting to worry that maybe I don't do that many interesting interviews. But anyway, it was nice of you to say what you said in your intro.
Well, if your ears are ever burning on a Sunday morning, we're often talking about your pieces. Don't worry about that.
Okay, I'm reassured.
So Wayne Rooney, a central figure in English football for near on 20 years, and Amazon have managed to get him on board for this documentary. Reading your piece and looking at some of the early trailers, it does seem, Ollie, as if rage and anger is a real theme here in Rooney's life.
Yeah, and yes, it certainly felt that way to me. And I think obviously in the process, I suppose, of A, watching this documentary, but B, looking back over his career and looking at some of the images, it is striking how many times, even when he's celebrating a goal, he's celebrating in an angry way. I think, as I said in that interview, it's almost, you know, as if he's taking revenge on somebody. There's very rarely pure joy in his expression. There does seem to be a lot of, you know, he carried a lot of pent up anger with him, I think, throughout his career. And look, Joe, that was also, you know, anybody who follows his career will know, I think, he took that into challenges as well sometimes. And there were, you know, he was sent off a few times. But I think those of us who, say, have followed his career would know that there are many more times where he could have gone because of the sort of the red, when the red mist appeared to come down.
Was he able to verbalise or explain the source of the rage?
Well, yes. He was really. I think his view of it would be, I think, that it emanated from a place where he's a kid growing up in a deprived area of Liverpool who loves football, and my apologies for lapsing into cliche, but lots of us have done it. He was a street footballer. He played, you know, he played with his mates as well as in organised teams for Everton. And he was utterly, utterly unprepared for the scrutiny, I think, that would come with becoming a professional footballer. And I suppose most of us chart his emergence into the limelight, that goal that he scored for Everton against Arsenal, which sort of catapulted him into sort of superstar fame at the age of 16. And I think the scrutiny that came with that was not kind. And obviously, I would have to include newspapers in that, but certainly also television programmes, chat show hosts. He particularly, I think, was hurt by some of the treatment he received at the hands of Jonathan Ross, which still burns in him. And I think that scrutiny, that I suppose judgment that was visited upon him left a seething anger in him.
I guess, like all of us, you remember the criticism vividly. So I suspect myself and most of the listeners and viewers here would have watched Jonathan Ross down the years. I've no memory really of Ross going after Rooney in any particular way, so I don't even know what you're talking about. And yet Rooney obviously remembers something very hurtful, which was said.
Yeah. So, no, I understand that. And when Jonathan Northcroft and I did the first interview that we did as a sort of prelude to the film, which was before Christmas, I mentioned to him that picture, famous picture, perhaps it would be more apt to say notorious picture of him and his family emerging from the sea. I think actually now I know it was from Cancun on a holiday that he and his parents went on back, you know, 20, probably nearly 20 years ago now. And that was widely mocked, partly by newspapers. You know, that I guess the general impression that was given was of sort of, look, let's all laugh at these kind of these working class people emerging from the ocean. Now, apparently, Jonathan Ross, I'm not a massive fan of Jonathan Ross. I don't think I ever saw it live, but Jonathan Ross, according to Rooney, was particularly vicious about that, to the point where Rooney said in the interview, you know, that if he, up until a few years ago, if he'd seen him, he would have hit him. I looked up a couple of things subsequently, just Googled Rooney, Jonathan Ross. I think Jonathan Ross seems to have had some kind of a bit of a adversarial relationship with Rooney, or seemed to, you know, he described, I think Rooney was recommended for some award of some sort, and Jonathan Ross made some comment about, is this a new category for people with tails? So, you know, the general vibe that was coming across there was that this guy is sort of subhuman, animalistic, whatever. Look, like you, Joe, I haven't been in the past a student of the Rooney Ross adversary, but having researched a little bit of this, I can see where some of Rooney's hurt comes from.
And it is striking, even in some of those descriptions of various moments, say between Ross and Rooney, for instance. I think sensibilities in the media have evolved and softened and changed. Even as you were talking there, I was thinking to Luke Chadwick, and in the past 18 months or so, the ugly jokes, which everybody laughed at, they were very public, it was just a thing. And suddenly when a mirror 10 years, 15 years on was held up to them, everybody could see how this was not a good way for a, you know, popular television show to behave, and Chadwick was kind of left to handle it all on his own. The other, I mean, I even feel like I'm contributing here a touch, but I know the documentary addresses, say, the brothel headlines, which, you know, were just associated with Rooney when he was a very, very young man. I suppose I never really stopped to think about the enormous embarrassment and the effect that that must have had on him. I mean, could you imagine to be in that position and you'd just be horrified that this private episode is just laid out in tabloid form and is tabloid fodder and gives everybody a laugh. And yet to be the person at the centre of it must have been utterly horrific. Did he reflect on that much?
Yes, he did, up to a point. And just before we get on to that, I agree with you about the way our sensibilities have changed. And you mentioned Luke Chadwick. I think also an example there maybe is, off the top of my head, something like Jason Lee with the pineapple on his head and that stuff, which was, I think, at one point considered fair game. And now we can see probably left quite a lasting impression on somebody and probably, you know, wouldn't be considered fair game anymore. I think as far as the embarrassment that you're talking about with Rooney, I think absolutely he did address that. And I think he didn't address the particular instance you were talking about, but right, he certainly talked about when he you know, his whatever euphemisms we want to address them as, his various indiscretions, misadventures, and the embarrassment, the acute embarrassment that he felt afterwards, and, you know, not wanting to go to the shops. If he did go to the supermarket, feeling that everybody was looking at him and judging him, and, you know, I suppose an acknowledgement that he'd, at some level, that he'd done the wrong thing. And I think there are, I think this is, there is footage of this in the trailers of the documentary that have been released, where there are some quite awkward, and I would say the better, in terms of the film, the better for them being awkward, exchanges between Colleen and Wayne Rooney on film, about that kind of stuff, where his wife addresses that and says that she forgave him for them, but that they were unacceptable. And I think the documentary is the better for that, in that I think a lot of films of this sort don't go there. You know, they don't try and confront that. And even though the exchanges that we have about them are limited, they still contribute to quite a sort of haunting picture in some ways. I think it's a very good documentary. And I said in the interview piece, I'm a massive fan of the Senna movie, and I'm also a huge fan of the Diego Maradona movie. And it's not that, it's not got the same kind of vibe as those movies. And I guess it would be slightly odd to describe the Senna movie as a feel-good movie, in that it ends with his death effectively. But nevertheless, there was something uplifting about the Senna movie. Whereas I think there's quite a lot of, you mentioned the sort of anger and the pain. There's quite a lot of that in the Rooney movie, and I think that it's better for that. It's honest, you know. It doesn't try and airbrush its subject.
Yeah, because it's very easy for us at large to say, well, he's paid enough money and he's famous and life's fine, so it's all fair game. The other quote which caught my eye in your piece was, he was talking about his drinking at Manchester United in his early years. So he said, in my early years at Manchester United, probably until we had my first son Kai, I locked myself away, really. I never went out. There were times you'd get a couple of days off from football, and I would actually lock myself away and just drink to take all that away from my mind. People might know that I liked to drink at times or went out, but there was a lot more to it than just that. It was what was going on in my head. Now, people would be more empowered to speak about that kind of thing these days. Back then, in my head and with other players, there was no way I could go into the United dressing room and start saying, this is how I'm feeling, because you just wouldn't do it. And then you'd end up suffering internally rather than letting your thoughts out. Locking myself away made me forget some of the issues I was dealing with. It was like a binge. So this is kind of a classic, and you hate to say it almost, but particularly of that era and before, that is a classic male sports person's way of trying to cope with being overwhelmed by everything which was going on around him at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think certainly in the discussions that Jonathan Northcroft and I had with him, I don't think he ever used the term mental health, but that effectively is that excerpt that you just read out, you know, that's effectively what he was talking about. And he did touch on the fact that he had at least isolated sort of flirtations with therapy and that kind of thing. But I think you're right. Again, you mentioned it earlier. We're not talking about that long ago.
No.
We talk about 15 years ago, but in some ways it feels like an awfully long time in terms of our attitudes towards mental health and our sensibilities towards mental health, our awareness of mental health. And look, I would obviously 100% include myself in that. I probably had a very limited awareness of those kind of things even 15 years ago. And I wasn't, it's not like I was young. I'd be in my, you know, late 30s, 40 then. I should have had more awareness, but I didn't. But I think we now have, as a society, you know, we have much more awareness of what people are going through. You know, we think, I think we discussed, Rooney and I and Johnny Northcroft, actually, after the tapes had stopped rolling, I think we were discussing the Stan Collymore's journey, for want of a better word, where I think John Gregory famously said, how can you be depressed when you're earning £100,000 a week or however much, whatever the sum was? And I think in some ways, Stan's experience, the way that he opened up, in some ways, it certainly in English football was, in my mind anyway, one of the beginnings of that journey where people began to be aware of mental health in among footballers and the pressures they're facing and the fact that earning a lot of money did not necessarily protect them or give them sanctuary from those kind of problems. So I think that, you know, we are seeing the fruition of a lot of those cases now.
He does say, just to add in, my relationship with drink now is fine, no problems. I still have a drink now and again, not like I used to, not like when I was playing. It's well in control. It was never at a stage where I thought I was an alcoholic. If I saw a couple of days window, I thought, right, that's a couple of days where I can go at it and try and forget things. I would never be going into training drunk. Ollie, does he reflect much on the heights of his playing career? Because, you know, God, time is flying by. For younger listeners, it's hard to overstate in real time. I'm sure they've seen the clips, but it's hard to overstate how exciting a prospect he was in 2002 when he scored that goal against Arsenal and then just blossomed on the global stage at Euro 2004. And as brilliant as he has been, and we are talking, I think, we can use the word great about a great player, who is the leading scorer for Manchester United, who is the leading scorer for England. These are incredible, incredible accolades to have. There is the nagging sense of unfulfilled potential. There is the nagging parallel of Cristiano Ronaldo, similar age, similar starting point, similar potential, who kept doing it right into his mid-30s, maybe even got better as each passing year went on, whereas Rooney almost aged like a traditional old-school footballer as his 30s arrived. And so there is the maybe uncharitable sense that he didn't fulfill the potential that we saw 2004 and yet still achieved so much. It's a curious balance when you're trying to put his career into context.
It is. You know, I'd actually agree with every word you said in that summation, actually, Joe. I made a limited contribution to this documentary as a sort of talking head, and I found that majority of what I was talking about, you know, if you're around long enough, then as I've been, then these things, you begin to put these things in perspective a little bit. But the majority of what I talked about and the majority of what I felt I knew about Rooney's career when I felt it the most keenly was Euro 2004, you know, when he was, I think he was 18 then. And I do remember that feeling. And as you say, people might not appreciate it now because his career, his career didn't exactly tail off, but his career maybe didn't quite hit those heights. There was a time at Euro 2004, and again, it's laughable in some ways. It was only in the early stages of in the group games and in the quarterfinal. But, you know, there was a time when it felt as if a door was opening for England, for the England men's football team. And that this, you know, this kid, as he was then, really, we were in at the beginning of something. We were in at the beginning of something really, really special, and that we had the best player in the world. I mean, the way that he tore apart the France side in I think it was our opening game of Euro 2004, a group game. We ended up losing the game, but he tore one of the best teams in the world apart and one of the best defences in the world apart. And he does talk about that in the documentary, and he talks unashamedly about the fact that he felt he was the best, not just the best player on that pitch against a France team that you know, had won the 98 World Cup and the Euros in 2000, but the best player in the world. He felt like he was the best player in the world and that nobody could touch him. And obviously, as English people, those of us who were there watching the game, we're obviously biased, but it felt like that to me at that time, that he was kind of untouchable. He was a talent to be judged alongside Messi and Ronaldo. And, you know, obviously it disappeared in a kind of puff of smoke when he was injured in that tournament. I am one of those who believe that we would have won that tournament if he had stayed fit. It's the closest, it's the only time I've felt that really in the last 30 years. And I think you're absolutely right to suggest that there is a sense that we never quite got there again. And partly that was because of bad luck at tournaments. 2006, he'd been injured before, he wasn't fit. 2008, England didn't qualify. 2010, he'd had a brilliant season that season, got injured in the spring, as I recall, in a Champions League game, never quite recovered his, you know, the form that he'd had in the rest of that season. 2010 World Cup was another terrible disappointment. And then, you know, by that stage, the prime of his career is gone. So we never did quite hit those heights again.
Do you know, it's so interesting. I'd have a very similar recollection. And 2010, I think it was an ankle injury that he took a long time to get over. And that was a period as well where he was slavishly up and down the left wing to compensate for Ronaldo at Manchester United. But like such a brilliant team ethic and team player and so remarkable. And yet 2010, my abiding image of him walking off the pitch after one of the England games is saying something down to camera, you know, about booing the team. And he looked like a man with the weight on his shoulders. And I think subsequently it transpired there were things going on off the pitch again that once again was intruding maybe on his potential. And in 2010, when he was saying that to camera, this sense of, man, it's over the hill, or like his English career is going to come to nothing. And then you have to stop and remind yourself he's like 24 there. You know, we're talking 6 years after 04, so 6 and 8, 24. And yet it almost felt like he was 30.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. And actually, it actually brings me up short, you mentioning it then. You're right. It felt like he was 30. That game was England-Algeria in Cape Town, which I think most people who were there would say it was one of the worst England games they've ever seen. I mean, it was a 0-0 draw. It was a miserable performance. And yeah, he said something about nice to see your own fans booing you into the camera. And yeah, it was, you know, he was still in many ways, he was still young then. But as you said earlier in this conversation, people, it's not just being wise after the event. People said it at the time. He aged quite quickly as a player. And look, I don't want to, again, lapse into laziness, and this probably is doing, but he had the kind of build, I think, he always had the kind of build that made people fear that he might fade, you know, quicker than a Ronaldo or a Messi, who had, you know, a lither frame, perhaps. He was quite a heavy set guy, which meant that he could excel at the age of 16, that he could mix it with grown men at the age of 16 and not have a problem. And again, looking back at the footage of him at 18 in Euro 2004, I mean, he was bullying those French defenders. There's footage of him absolutely smashing into Lilian Thuram in that game in a challenge that he admits now, if that happened now, he'd been sent off. But, you know, he absolutely terrorised that defence at the age of 18. But I suppose having matured so young, maybe there's a logic to the fact that he would fade more quickly as he got towards his late 20s.
And you're right, it was said at the time, even when he first came on the scene. Hey, what do you think, by the way, is his motivation for this documentary? I mean, it's tried to say money. I suspect Wayne Rooney's doing okay financially, but like to talk about the rage, to revisit some of the embarrassing off the field instances at this point in his managerial career. I was kind of trying to work out what's the strategy here, for want of a better word.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would be pretty sure it's not money. And obviously, that's a fairly rare thing to say. If you have been around as long as me, you know, if in doubt, it's money. But I would pretty much be sure that in this case, it's not money. I don't know how much he's been paid for it, but I would say that was not the prime motivation at all. I think that part of it, and I haven't spoken to him directly about this, Joe, so I don't know. But I think that what he has said openly is that he would like people to see a different side of him. I suspect he's become slightly frustrated by this idea of him as some sort of party animal who is always getting himself into scrapes. And I think that his view of that is very much those are isolated incidents, and that he actually very rarely goes out, that he's quite a solitary person. But when he does go out, it tends to, you know, he tends to create unwanted headlines. I suspect also at some level, and I stress, he didn't say this to me. I suspect at some level that he's at a different stage of his career now. He's winning lots of plaudits for, quite rightly, I think, for the dignity and the ability with which he is managing at Derby County in very difficult circumstances. I suspect that there is some, you know, I would think that there is maybe some element where he would hope that a documentary such as this would draw a line under his playing career, and some of the off the field incidents that accompanied it would draw a line under all that and allow him to move on and be seen in a more serious light as somebody who can lead a club.
Yeah.
And I think actually, Joe, one of the things that occurred to me about that was that, you know, if he wants to achieve that, then I hope that this documentary will help with that. But actually, I think that the way that he has conducted himself already at Derby, and I'm thinking particularly about the statement that he made about the interest from Everton in him and how he felt that he couldn't leave Derby in the circumstances in which they're in now. I think that did an immense amount for his popularity and the way that people regard him, actually, because I think we all know that loyalty is a fairly rare commodity in football, not just from players, but from clubs as well. And for him to show that kind of loyalty to a club that's in trouble, I think spoke volumes about him.
Yeah, I think he has always struck me as a sincere person, actually, who hasn't lost the head or run away from himself. Now, actually, though, in a bid to establish himself as managerial material and ready to kind of handle all the pressures that go with it, he did, in the publicity this week, catch the eye even of the FA. So here he is, I think, yeah, being honest to a fault, really. So talking about John Terry in 06, just have a listen.
I always wore the old plastic studs with the metal tip.
Right.
And for that game, I changed them to big, long metal ones. Mm. So they were the maximum length you could have, because I wanted to Trying to hurt someone, trying to injure someone.
Did you?
Shall we get a camera on you?
Okay, on that note. Yeah. You were that angry? You were that
uptight? I knew that they were going to win that game. You could feel they were a better team than us at the time. So I changed my studs, thinking the studs were legal, but thinking if there's a challenge there, I knew I'd want to go in for it properly. Mm. Basically, and I did actually. John Terry left the stadium on crutches. I left a hole in his foot here, and then I signed my shirt after the game to him and asked for my stuff back.
So there you go. I mean, it's Roy Keane, Alfie Inge Haaland, only more indiscriminate, which is probably not a good thing. I think it may cross the minds of a few chairmen, fairly or otherwise, Ollie. Well, I don't want a manager who's going to put his foot in it. Whatever about the crime, people probably get over it, you know, tough tackles and all that kind of thing. But I mean, why reveal it? I don't really know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I guess, as you said earlier, he wanted to be, I suppose he very much, you know, made a point of the fact that he wanted this documentary, to be honest. And you know, he didn't want to leave any stone unturned, and I think he has done that in the documentary. So I guess it was part of that. I think maybe, you know, he's, again, going back to your earlier question about, is there a strategy here? It's almost like he wants to get all of this stuff out there and then it's done.
Yeah.
It's done with. And I think, look, the admission that he makes about the, about changing to the studs is quite startling. You will very rarely hear a player admit that they go out to hurt someone. And in fact, you know, most of the time I hear players say that no player goes out to hurt somebody. And I think it was very interesting that Rooney acknowledged that. I'd also say, again, I've watched footage. There is footage in the documentary of the tackle in question between him and John Terry. We're talking about how things have changed in terms of our attitudes to mental health in the past 15 years or so. I think they've also changed in terms of our attitudes to what was acceptable in football or not. And that was a fairly, John Terry was not a shrinking violet either. And that tackle was two aggressive players colliding. And John Terry, if you look at even stills of the tackle, John Terry goes into that tackle with both feet off the ground. And Rooney stamps on him on the way through, effectively. So, yeah, it wasn't an act of unrequited aggression, if I can put it that way. I am obviously in no way seeking to excuse it. All I'm saying is that it was a different time as well. But I mean, Rooney has been so honest about it that clearly there's not a lot of wriggle room there. As far as, you know, you saying, talking about, you know, there's some suggestion the FA are looking at it and whether any prospective employers might look at it. I think Rooney's response to that would be, I suspect that it happened a long time ago. Mm. They were different times, and he is, I would say, quite clearly a very different person now. I mean, I think... you know, that's an argument that we can have in football and in sport a lot. You know, we see this quite a lot, obviously, with, say, an obvious thing, I suppose, is with social media posts that players may have made 10 or 15 years ago and that come back to haunt them. They're different people. And I think that Rooney would say that he is a different person now. He's got rid of a lot of that anger, finally, that infused him in those days. And look, I think everything that he's shown at Derby County and its early days, obviously first job in management, has shown that he is more than capable of being a leader at a football club. And I think that, you know, that has been a surprise to a lot of people. But I think with every match that goes on, you know, they won again last night. And if he leads Derby County to survival in the Championship, which is still a big if, it'll be one of the great managerial achievements. It'll be one of the great escapes in English football history. It's not a bad thing to have on his CV.
No, for sure. Well, people can still check out the interview you did with him. It's on the Mail website, obviously, and it is well worth a read. In 30 seconds, if you have it, because I've kept you too long, you'd have a good feel for the news cycle and whether a story is gathering momentum or losing momentum. This Kurt Zouma situation seems to be gathering momentum, and in hindsight, maybe West Ham could have taken some of the sting out of this by benching him last night and you know, really making it clear that this was sincerely unacceptable, as opposed to just releasing a statement unacceptable. So I suspect this could be something you're writing about on Sunday and others.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with your summation of that, Joe. I think that in an ideal world, they would have left him out last night, certainly, as a gesture of disapproval and censure. It's an interesting question of where it goes from here, and whether it's gathering pace or not. I get the vague impression that West Ham's finding him 2 weeks' wages, which people are saying is £250,000, and donating that to animal charities will appease some of the anger that has built about their dealing of the way they've dealt with the situation. And it is a good thing that it's a good thing that they've done that. But yes, it's a difficult thing. I find the situation difficult in terms of, obviously not in terms of Kurt Zuma and what he did, but the criticism that David Moyes received last night for playing him. I totally understand that, and I think that he should have been left out. But I also think that David Moyes, sorry to be again cliched and a little bit reductive, I think David Moyes is a good man, and I think his actions over the years have proved that he is a good man and a good manager. And I think that I kind of understand where he's coming from about trying to separate the football and the discipline. And he, Zuma has been disciplined today. I also, you know, and again, this may be cynical of me, it probably is, but it strikes me that if Moyes, if they hadn't played Zuma last night, and say West Ham had lost, lost another couple of games maybe, and suddenly find themselves in eighth rather than fourth, West Ham fans would have forgotten about the poor cat and would be maybe calling for Moyes to be sacked. So, you know, it's a difficult decision. I think he should have been left out last night, and I think by not leaving him out, the anger about the way about Zuma's behaviour and the cruelty towards the cat, that anger may have risked it building, and it may be that the decision to fine him heavily and to channel that money towards animal charities dissolves some of that anger. But it's an interesting one. England's a nation of pet lovers, and I think some of the emotions that this footage has stirred reflects that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time. It's great to have you on. Let's not leave it 6 years the next time, okay?
And, yeah, I'll try and do another decent interview sometime soon.
No, listen, you're doing it pretty much most weeks. Ollie Holt, a chief sports writer with the Mail on Sunday. Thanks very much, Ollie. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, Joe.
Cheers. And our football coverage is with thanks to Sky. Don't miss Liverpool-Leicester Thursday night live only on BT Sport. We'll take a short break.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky, proud partner and supporter of the Republic of Ireland women's national football team.
This is News Talk.
Now, you're very welcome back to the show. Happy to bring in Laurie Whitwell, who covers Manchester United day in, day out. Laurie, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
It's, when you take a step back, it's almost staggering how dreadful a mess this whole thing is, coming up on 10 years since Alex Ferguson departed. I mean, it's been a fairly miserable 10 years and right now feels as miserable as ever.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a disconnect between the fans, the team. You've got discord from manager to players in terms of what he says and then what they go and put on social media. You've got the uncertainty over who might take over from him. And United feel further away, you know, than ever from a title challenge, which seems, I guess, quite bizarre when you think of the optimism that there was at the start of the season and the idea that this could actually be a challenging squad. I think the inadequacies of it have been exposed as the season's gone on. It feels like you've got Ralph Rangnick there, who's an erudite, smart guy, knows football inside out, but he's new to English football. The coaches that he has there are new to English football. And it feels like they're kind of discovering things as the season goes on. And it's causing a drift for Manchester United. And really that top four spot that he said is the ambition for Manchester United looks actually like it's not necessarily going to be guaranteed at all. You know, you've got a lot of teams there in the hunt for it. So a real sense of disquiet about the place at the moment.
For anybody who didn't see the 1-0 draw at Turf Moor last night, Laurie, what would you say about it?
Probably Harry Maguire is the main talking point out of it, because he seemed lost for their goal when Weghorst spun in brilliantly. He possibly could have got a red card when he kind of clotheslined Jay Rodriguez as you know, the last man. It probably wasn't a goal scoring opportunity as clear as anything, but it was a risky one. I mean, really, ultimately, it boils down to United actually losing their way in the game, because they started pretty well. You know, they had two goals disallowed. I think one certainly was very, very harsh when Pogba kind of, you know, clattered with Peters, and it was an own goal in the end from Rashford's cross. But then in the second half, you know, United stepped off, Burnley stepped up, and it looked too rushed from United's perspective. There wasn't a kind of concerted effort to get over the line, and it was only really one shot that they had, the back heel from Varane. Whereas, you know, you'd really like to think that United would have been camped in Burnley's half. I mean, this is the team at the bottom of the table in the Premier League, Burnley, and United couldn't see them off. And this has been a consistent theme after the Middlesbrough game in the FA Cup, having chances and not putting them away. There's been only three games under Ralph Rangnick in 12 matches where United have scored more than one in the game. So goal scoring really is an issue, despite having Cavani, Ronaldo, Rashford, Sancho all on the pitch. It's a real quandary.
Ralph Rangnick's a curious character to work out at the moment, because I would say he's quite impressive and composed in all his media dealings, and comes across as somebody very much in control of himself and the broader situation. And yet, on the pitch, and even when it comes to things like the Martial situation and the Lingard situation, doesn't seem all that in control of things either.
Yeah, it's a real funny sort of debate on what he says in his press conference, because on the one hand, you have fans that really admire it, and you've got them sort of loving the fact that he's pretty open about things. You know, he says it how he sees it. He's got that kind of way about him where it's just very matter of fact. And I think after having Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager, who would obviously try and massage certain situations, I think the fans have warmed to that. Now, is that Ralph Rangnick just being as he is, or is that Ralph Rangnick thinking he needs to preserve himself in this situation, which is clearly far from ideal and could unravel, and making sure that he is seen to be making the right calls on certain situations and won't, you know, be kowtowed by players having too much power, which has been a kind of criticism of Manchester United for a long time, under this, you know, under Ed Woodward as chief executive, giving players too much authority in certain situations and taking it from the manager. But then on the flip side, you know, does he still need to have these players on side so that he can actually get results? I mean, I suppose Jesse Lingard came off the bench last night, and Anthony Martial came off the bench after they'd had their sort of disagreement. So perhaps he's just thinking, well, you know, it's a pragmatic situation. I can say how I feel, but they can still perform on the pitch at the end of the day. I mean, I suppose it's a temporary situation with him, isn't it? It's interim manager. He's not having to think long term. And I suppose that's where the essence of his comments are coming from. But it does, it creates a bit of an unsavoury atmosphere, I would say, for all that Ralph Rangnick might be right in what he says.
Yeah, because once being unfortunate and twice being careless, for Martial and Lingard to publicly use social media to say, no, he's got this all wrong, does bring questions over Rangnick's communication ability. What are you hearing? Because we have heard a lot of leaks and a lot of different reports about the extent to which the players are or are not impressed with Rangnick. What are you hearing, Laurie?
Yeah, I mean, with the Martial situation, we did a piece on The Athletic at the time where he had got a third party, basically a colleague, to go and ask Martial if he was, you know, ready to play. And then that seems to be a miscommunication where it came back that Martial, I think, didn't really want to put himself out there. But equally, he wasn't saying, no, I will not play if you pick me. And that's obviously how it then came out after the Aston Villa game. So you can perhaps criticise Rangnick there for not taking the mantle and asking the player himself. Equally, I think he had reason to test the player. I think there've been some disagreements over whether he was fit enough or not in previous situations. But it creates this kind of unsettling atmosphere around the place, I guess. And yeah, I mean, in terms of whether the players are impressed or not, I think, you know, for example, Paul Pogba had a really good conversation with him when he came back, and I think he's actually returned to the team and done pretty well in his two games so far. So perhaps he's one that would say, no, actually, I'm on board with what Ralph Rangnick's trying to do. Others, certainly when he first came in, you know, the 4-2-2-2 situation, I don't think that suited the players, the kind of makeup of the squad. You know, it put a lot of emphasis on the fullbacks, you know, in terms of Telles and Dalot at the time, you know, Luke Shaw now in the picture more, but like not necessarily United's strongest part of the team, and they were actually therefore given a lot of license to go forward and really create. And I think players perhaps felt that this was shoehorning you know, an idea onto them that wasn't really suitable. And then at the same time, in the training sessions, you know, you've got somebody from the MLS in Chris Armas, who I think, you know, clearly Ralf Rangnick knows from previously working in the Red Bull system, but is he also trying to keep up with the demands of Premier League football? And I think the only issue there is perhaps that, you know, you can criticise players for just listen to the guy, you know, he's a coach, but at the same time, you kind of either come in as a coach with authority from what you've done in the past or then what you produce on the training pitch. And I think Chris Armas, from their point of view, you know, they didn't necessarily see the pedigree that he was coming with from the MLS. So it's been a kind of gradual process where they've, I think, got better. I think the relationship has, you know, improved. You can see that there's some, you know, patterns of play that look pretty exciting on the pitch. But ultimately, it does seem a bit rushed at times, you know. So they're winning the ball back and kind of getting it forward straight away, whereas a foot on the ball, a bit of patience might have worked certainly better against Burnley.
Because they were nothing short of abysmal in the 4-2-2-2. Period. There were games at St James's Park and a few others where it was shambolic. And then, as you said, it started to improve a touch. But still, across January, we're talking two wins, two draws, and the penalty shootout loss in the FA Cup. I mean, you'd struggle to do much worse with the caliber of player he has at his disposal. So it's really jury out, I think, as well. And the Pogba thing, for instance, and this gets to the heart of the problem and the limbo that Manchester United are in. So the Pogba's back and he has a good game here and maybe he has a great month and people are saying, well, you know, sign him up. Like, Pogba's the perfect exemplar of the kind of player the next manager may look at and say, I do not want this player anywhere near my plans. And yet Manchester United could be on the cusp of offering him a huge deal. And, you know, does Rangnick have a say in that? Does it matter if he has a say in that? Are they in communication with potentially the next manager? There's just this constant sense of nothing there is aligned in a healthy way. And whether they let Pogba go for nothing or whether they sign him and offer him £500,000 a week or £300,000 a week, you just feel like this is not a smart way of doing business. It's not a football way of doing business. And they're just destined into the next tenure to have problems like Pogba.
Yeah, you're spot on. I think there's a lack of leadership really from the executive. So you've obviously got Richard Arnold taking over from Ed Woodward, and I think he's kind of trying to get to grips with this situation that he's now inheriting. But you do have this state of kind of drift really, where there needs to be strong personalities in there overseeing the squad makeup, deciding these kind of things, you know, immediately. You know, as you say, how can you have a situation where you're going into a summer, you don't necessarily know who your manager's going to be? Clearly, we've, you know, heard talks about Mauricio Pochettino or Erik ten Hag. But as you say, you know, really, they would want to have a look at the squad first before you make any kind of major decisions like this. I mean, Paul Pogba has been offered a contract at Manchester United since, you know, last summer. It's kind of on the table still. And, you know, still he's kind of waiting to see. And I think his, you know, impression of whether he signs that or whether he stays at United will be on how he feels at the time, you know, when it comes to the end of the season, which, you know, is perhaps the tail wagging the dog, really. Yeah. And it's not a satisfactory situation. But United allow this to happen time and again, where they let situations just kind of trundle on without any kind of sense of, you know, urgency, where they have to grasp it and get to grips with it. Yeah. Ralf Rangnick, he, you know, I think he ideally would have wanted players in January, certainly, you know, with letting go of Anthony Martial. I think he would have happily, you know, said to Jesse Lingard, you can go to Newcastle. He was overruled on that decision by the board. So you can kind of get a sense of where his authority lies in this situation. And also with the Mason Greenwood thing, you know, he's going to be out for the foreseeable future. He obviously would have wanted a player in. Ralf Rangnick mentioned Greenwood twice in his pre-match press conference in terms of Cavani and Lingard, allowing Cavani an extra couple of days back in Uruguay. Therefore, he missed the Middlesbrough match. So, you know, he clearly is thinking of that as a part of the squad that he would have liked to solve. But United basically said, we're not going to react to situations and bring in players that perhaps cost a lot of money and the next manager might not want. But then you get this sense of, you know, kind of, it feels like a lack of care, really, where, you know, they're kind of just letting things, I've said it before, but drift. And it will become a crucial point if they don't make the top four, because Champions League money and the ability to attract players will be huge in that regard.
Well, everything you said there would be so worrying from a Manchester United point of view. So here is your current interim manager who's working with the players every day, and he's your future, on a consultancy basis or otherwise, director of football type. and he's making recommendations or his views on players are being ignored. Therefore, what is the point in having Rangnick stay on for a further 2 years if you value his opinion so little whilst he's working with the players currently? I mean, it's just none of this makes any sense. It is staggering how badly this club is being run. And I would think, say it's Pochettino. I think it's entirely possible Pochettino would look at Paul Pogba and say, look, I want akin to Rangnick. I want high pressing. I want a certain kind of energy or attitude in midfield. And so am I going to put a $500,000 player a week on the bench? That's just going to create trouble. So I don't know. It's kind of hard not to think that they're just in this real state of limbo. What's the Ronaldo situation now? He's equaled his longest drought in 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years.
You know, this is the, I mean, they're talking about Boris Johnson's toxic embrace. This is the Manchester United toxic embrace now. Come close and we'll really ruin you. So where is Rangnick with Ronaldo, do you suspect? And where is Ronaldo with Manchester United? I can't think he wants to see out his closing days in this kind of a situation.
Yeah, I mean, we heard whispers of it sort of way back when it was kind of spiral under Solskjaer, you know, this idea from teammates that, you know, they kind of sensed would Ronaldo actually stick around for, you know, his second year. I mean, he's actually got an option of a third year. So, you know, on paper, it would be two more years. But
Boris and Ronaldo to be here in 2 years' time. What are the odds, Larry?
I don't know. This is the thing. You think no right now, don't you? You think something's got to give, particularly, you know, with a certain prime minister. But, you know, he survived worse and, you know, maybe Ronaldo, maybe they're locked in this embrace because he's on an awful lot of money. Mm. Where does he go from Manchester United? Albeit, you know, he might think, actually, I'd rather have some kind of silverware at the end of my career than this sort of state of flux and kind of, you know, disappointment. I mean, I suppose the Champions League gives some salvation. You know, they've got Atletico Madrid towards the end of this month and, you know, stranger things have happened. You know, teams have made it to the final, which haven't been, you know, anywhere near the best teams in Europe. So you never know, they could get lucky. But I think, yeah, the Ronaldo thing has been something that Rangnick sort of wrestled with. That was the first time that he started him on the bench in a game. He's not been in the team before, but he's been sort of injured. So this is the kind of first time that he could have picked him and he put him on the bench. But then he traded out Cavani rather than put them on up top together, which I think perhaps might have worked a bit better against Burnley, sort of being quite narrow and letting United have it in wide areas, sort of have another sort of central forward. Perhaps would have broken the stalemate. But yeah, I think he clearly really would like, I mean, he said it before the game, didn't he, in terms of Cavani, he likes players from the front that can press high, that can run around. And Ronaldo just isn't that player. You know, he probably hasn't ever properly been that player, but United compensated back in the day, even when he was a winger, with getting people that could do that. Wayne Rooney, for example, doing a lot of the legwork. And but I think he's another one where, as you said about Pogba, you know, if he signs for a mega contract, every time that Ronaldo's not in the starting lineup, it's a story, it's a kind of debating point, and that can wear the situation down. And clearly Ronaldo is not someone who's, you know, content to sit on the bench. You know, we see him run off at the end of games, pretty sharpish. He doesn't hide his feelings. He certainly made his feelings clear on wanting to play an awful lot. So
that's by the way, poor enough again. As I understand it, I didn't see the full game, but I think he was sharpish down the tunnel again.
He's
not naive. He knows what message that sends out. I am not happy.
Yeah, I think so. He did it after the Everton game. That was the first one where it looked, you know, kind of deliberate, I suppose.
Pointed, yeah.
And obviously, he'd started on the bench in that game. And, you know, we saw the Sir Alex Ferguson video with Khabib, the UFC fighter afterwards, which is the most surreal episode, I think, in recent years.
Yeah.
But yeah, clearly, and he's done this sort of frequently. And it's been raised, you know, by people. You know, Gary Neville obviously has raised it. And in turn, I think people have noticed it. I mean, I actually noticed just before coming on that he sent out a tweet of him fist bumping a young fan last night after the game, after everyone I think had gone away. So perhaps he is aware of this idea that he's not connected to the fans and wants to kind of address it in that way at least. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, somebody said to me that actually there is a worry about getting mobbed by fans. And I was at Newcastle, and you're right by the tunnel at Newcastle in the press box, and he ran off really sharpish after that, and someone did run on the pitch to try and get him. So,
do you know what? Yeah. That's a fair enough point, actually. He does get mobbed. I mean, even he played in Dublin and he got mobbed at full time. So to be fair, actually, maybe there's a bit of that to give him the benefit of the doubt. So, well, I presume he'll start scoring eventually once he's started again. The coming weeks, how are they shaping up for Manchester United? Have they got a good run of fixtures? Because fourth place is hanging in the balance now, and then there's Europe. So, I mean, what's the prognosis here? Laurie, as a final word?
Yeah, I mean, they've had a sort of fairly modest run anyway, haven't they? And as you said earlier, the results haven't actually, you know, been very modest. They've got Southampton at home on Saturday, and then Brighton at home in the delayed match on Tuesday, and then Leeds away on the Sunday, and then Atletico Madrid away. You know, so it's you'd think that these next two games, they really have to win back-to-back at home, you know, to teams lower down in the table. Okay, they're good football inside, but, you know, if United are going to finish in the top four, and perhaps actually they might be better against football inside, a bit more space, you know, particularly on the transition, which is clearly where Ranić feels that he wants his team to play. So, but we've said it before, it's felt like they haven't really hit any heights under Ranić.
No.
I mean, you know, Burnley at home, maybe. I mean, maybe West Ham was probably, you know, the late winner, and that overall as a performance was fairly controlled and pretty good, whilst at the same time not really creating all that much.
If we manage them, Laurie, me and you as a dream duo, they'd hit some heights eventually in some of the games, you know?
There's nothing consistent. The
yeah, do what Laurie said. But, you know, they would. They have such a calibre of player that, like, glimpses, of course, are going to happen. But I think Manchester United fans hoped when Rangnick arrived there'd be a real methodology on view. And bar the first half where they pressed and the mood took them, I don't know.
Well, there's an idea that the philosophy that Ralph Rangnick's got is suitable for teams of the Southampton ilk and of the Leipzig ilk, you know, in Europe, where, you know, they perhaps are slightly underdogs, and, you know, it'll certainly be the majority of teams, but against the top sides, it'll come unstuck. And I think when you look at a team like Manchester United, they need to have perhaps, you know, they should be having a lot of possession of the ball. It shouldn't be that they're trying to win it high up and you know, turn over. I know that Liverpool play in a sort of way like that, but it's more modified than I think what United are playing right now. There's obviously more composure to it. And listen, obviously it's been years in the making at Liverpool. I think that'd probably be unfair to judge Ranić by what Klopp's been able to achieve in 5 or 6 years at Anfield. But at the same time, that there is a sense, you know, when you speak to people in Europe, that actually it is tweaked. It's more of a considered approach, not, you know, too chaotic. Whereas, you know, I think the idea of winning the ball back quickly and having verticality perhaps doesn't suit United's players ultimately. But listen, he's the man in charge right now. And as I say, he is clearly a very sharp, intelligent guy. And I think you can see some progress with the team. I think that's fair to say. But whether or not there's been enough progress, or whether there will be progress from here to the end of the season, is a real question mark.
Okay. I suspect somehow you're going to be kept busy for The Athletic. Laurie Whitwell, thanks so much for coming on. Much appreciated.
Cheers, Joe. See you later.
Thanks a million. Laurie Whitwell there, giving us his take on Manchester United's 1-1 draw last night at Turf Moor. Our football show coverage is with thanks to Sky. Don't miss Liverpool-Leicester on Thursday night. It's live on BT Sport.
Your brand deserves better than one-size-fits-all branded clothing. Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your team will want to wear. Backed by above and beyond expertise, go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product.